living in this land in which we live and under these very favorable circumstances that surround us, it's very difficult for us to realize what the early church was facing and passed through in that first century. The book of Revelation, as we studied the seven letters, we learned that there were tribulations from without, and there were conditions from within that threatened the very life of the church of that day. Externally, they were going to suffer tribulation. One of the congregations lived where Satan's throne was. That was at Sentinel, the center of worship or Roman worship. There it was, emperor worship. Another one was situated where the synagogue of Satan, the synagogue of Satan existed, made up of Jews, of men who said they were Jews, but they were not. They were a synagogue of the devil. And so you have these external conditions, and internally, one congregation left its first love. Another congregation suffered individuals to hold to the doctrine of Balaam. And then there was the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. Another congregation suffered a woman, Jezebel, who came to the apostles to teach a doctrine there and seduce the brethren to commit spiritual adultery and the worship of idols, things of that nature. Another congregation was completely satisfied, and they were neither warm nor neither hot nor cold, but lukewarm. Lord said, "I'll spew you out of the mouth." So we think today that we have problems, and yet we don't have many compared to what they had back then. We sometimes speak of the New Testament church or the ideal church, but what are we talking about? No, we're talking about an ideal that God set before the people for the church, as He condemned these things they were doing and told them what to do. We do have an ideal. But apart from the Jerusalem church when it was first established, I don't know of an ideal congregation among all of them. There was something wrong with the various ones, with a very few exceptions. We have two in the Revelation letter, nothing against them. The Philippian church, which I suppose is probably one of the better congregations to which Paul addressed a letter, and yet they had problems. They had two women there that were in disagreement. They had other things there that they had to face. So as you look at all of this, and as the church faced the future that was about to break forth in the whole Roman Empire, a storm against the church of the Lord throughout the empire in every place. Now that storm of persecution would last for something like 200 or 220 more years after the Revelation letter went, 249 years from the time of the persecution in Rome by Nero. That's 2.5 centuries that they would have periodically. There would be a strong persecution, but live about over that one, and then they would survive for a few years. They would get worldly, another persecution would come, and they would again endure severe persecution, death, martyrdom, all of these things. Now, before the storm breaks in its total fury, God draws back the scene or opened the door of heaven and gave to His saints through John a revelation of the throne of the universe. Now, this was to encourage them. As we look at this fourth chapter tonight, this is a picture of the throne of the universe. But now, as you read the chapter, chapters 4 and 5, remember that God is revealing this in vision. We're not to take this as literal, a literal throne and literal living creatures and 24 thrones on it with the elders sitting upon them. But these are pictures. Now, we have in this, in the various epistles and in the Gospels, we have lessons taught directly by word in the way of teaching through words. But in the Revelation letter, we have these great lessons taught in picture form, the ideas. So ideas are expressed in these symbols through which God is revealing truth unto His people. So as we look at this fourth chapter tonight, the throne of the universe, We see there the great majestic throne of God, Him who sits upon it, and then all of His court there that are serving Him. Four living creatures, 24 elders on thrones, great multitude of angels round about, all of this. It's a majestic picture. It's a grand picture. It's a beautiful picture. And I'm sure the heaven's going to surpass even this picture. But this picture is to encourage the saints with the assurance that God is on His throne, God is in control. And so that, and He has all of heaven and earth to serving Him, to be used of Him in carrying out His purpose. This is what we will see in chapters 4 and 5. I want us to look at chapter 4 tonight, chapter 5 next Sunday night. The two of them go together. The theme of the chapter 4 is the throne and the throne occupant, the one who sits upon the throne. Chapter 5, the emphasis on the Lamb, who is of the tribe of Judah, the Lion, and the Lamb is both the Lion and the Lamb, of the tribe of Judah, who has overcome to take the book out of the right hand of God and open the seals of that book and point out the one who will carry out God's plan of purpose unto its ultimate consummation. Now remember, we're looking at pictures. Pictures that convey ideas, that convey great truths. And in these great truths, we want to rest our faith and our hope as those people did back there. Now, as I said, very difficult for us to understand what they went through. I personally have never suffered persecution at the hands of anybody or what I preached. I doubt if you have. We've had people say ugly things about us, something like that, or charges, or mischarges, misaccuses, and all of that, things. But that's no real persecution. Convey ideas that convey great truths. And in these great truths, we want to rest our faith and our hope as those people did back there. Now, as I said, very difficult for us to understand what they went through. I personally have never suffered persecution at the hands of anybody or what I preached. I doubt if you have. We've had people say ugly things about us, something like that, or charges, or mischarges, misaccuses, and all of that, things. But that's no real persecution. Well, that just is nothing compared to what those people went through back there in that day. And so, before the storm breaks in its the fullness of its fury, God gives us a picture, or gave to them a picture, of the throne that rules the universe, and that all things are subject under that throne. Therefore, you take courage. Overcome. Do what He said in the seven letters. He that overcometh shall inherit these things. So it's the overcomer through faith in the throne and the power of that throne who overcomes these trials and tribulations. These are the ones that are going to receive the crown, going to receive the blessing, the reward, whatever it might be pictured. And all those, in all seven letters, the rewards there for overcoming all simply sum up and symbolize victory now and the crown after a while. Crown of eternal life, when this life is over. So that gives us courage and hope. I think it's just not a book anywhere that's more discouraging in one way and fearful in that way, and yet more encouraging in another way. It's totally discouraging to the world. The world and those that live in the world and that live according to the world, they are doomed to defeat and destruction. To the individual who endures and overcomes, why, then he is destined to victory and the crown of eternal life. So it's both discouraging from the world's point of view. It's encouraging from the viewpoint of the faithful individual. Now, if we can get that lesson and get that picture, why, then I think that we will have what God intended that we should have from this great book. Now, let us begin reading from the fourth chapter here. And the first three verses deal with the throne and its occupant, 1-3. After these things, now that's not so much a matter of time, a long period of time, but this follows. Here's what follows, the dictating of the letters. After these things I saw, and behold, a door opened in heaven, And the voice, first voice that I heard, a voice as of a trumpet speaking with me, one saying, come up hither, and I will show thee the things which must come to pass hereafter. Now this is to John. Now this is the third door that we've had in our study. Back in the third chapter, in verse 8, Jesus said to the church at Philadelphia, he said, I've set before you a door open, which no man can shut. And so I've given you a little power. And that was the door of opportunity, the door to serve. Dropping down to the 21st verse of the same chapter, in the letter to Laodicea, he said, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open, I will come in unto him and sup with him, and he with me. Now that's the door of the heart. So now here we have the door of opportunity. We have the door of the heart, which Jesus, upon which he knocks and seeks an admission into the life and the soul of the individual. Now this is the third. This is the door of heaven. Now that you saw a door open here in heaven, you will notice there. I saw a door open in heaven. And now he sees a throne set in that. Now he doesn't see the thrones already, but in this vision now, here the door is open. He's brought into it, and now he sees a throne set in the vision. Then he sees these things that follow that. So the throne is the emphatic thought here. The word throne occurs 17 times in chapters 4 and 5. Well, I don't know if there's any significance to 17, but 10, 7 is the perfect number. So a 10 is the power number. And when power is combined with a perfection, 3 is the divine number, 4 is the world number, that's 7, that's perfection, and 10 is power. When you put the perfection of the 7 with the power of the 10, you have a picture there of both perfection and strength. Now, whether that's the idea, I don't know. I just know that in these two chapters, the word throne occurs 17 times, focusing attention upon the throne as the central part of this vision. Now we want to keep that in mind. So we also think of this. As we study these lessons from night to night, let's try to think of ourselves as sitting in a great arena. And over here is being acted before us this great drama of conflict. The conflict between God and Satan. The conflict between God's people and the forces of Satan that would try to destroy them. And so here, scene after scene passes before us on this stage as we are sitting and watching it as it takes place now. I think if you try to think of this like that, that we'll get a lot more enjoyment out of it than trying to determine whatever little aspect of it. Much of it is simply stage drapery. And so as we look at it, we may not be able to understand all of the different figures and things. It won't matter. We get the picture. The picture is conflict, war, spiritual war, and the victory of one group and the defeat of the other. God's people come out victorious. The devil and his forces are cast in the lake of fire, forever eternally separated from the righteous and from God and the things that are good. Now this is the lesson. I think the book of Revelation have us together. So we move on in verse 2. Straightway I was in the Spirit, and behold, there was a throne set in heaven, and one sitting upon the throne, and he that sat was like unto a jasper stone and a sardius. And there was a rainbow round about the throne, like an emerald to look upon. Right, we get the picture. Now, if you're looking at the picture here, here and I is a throne set. And then we see one sitting upon it, but he's not described. He's not described by any physical attributes whatever. Now this differs from the throne seen of Ezekiel back in the first chapter. The one sitting on the throne there had the appearance, or rather was as the appearance of a man. It was not a man, but as the appearance of one. But this one presents the one on the throne as like unto a sardius stone and like unto a jasper stone. Now the sardius stone was a brilliant white gem, generally thought that this was the diamond. Here is a flashing diamond. And the other, the sardius,
was like like unto a jasper stone. The jasper stone was a red stone, fiery red, like a fiery red ruby. So it seemed that these are the, what he sees there then, the flashing forth of two gem-like things on the throne. Now they symbolize something. They're symbols, you see. What do they symbolize? Well, I think from Psalm 89, verses 14 and 15, righteousness and justice are the foundation of thy throne. Loving kindness and truth go before thy face. Blessed are the people that know the joyful sound, for they said rejoice in his presence, or receive the blessings of it. And then in the 92nd Psalm, in verses 2 and 3, his righteousness and justice are the foundation of his throne. A fire goeth before his face and burneth up the adversaries round about. Now here you have two pictures of the foundation of God's throne. Justice and righteousness are the foundation of it. Now I think the white flashing diamond symbolizes the righteousness of him who sits upon the throne, whereas the fiery red ruby symbolizes the justice of his judgment on the throne. They're both symbols. Now that seems to me to be the symbolic idea there. Then you move on around about the throne, there was a rainbow like unto an emerald. And as you look at it now, the emerald was green, a velvety green emerald here. Well, what does it symbolize? Maybe one of two things. When you see the rainbow, you're apart from the storm. The storm is out beyond. So here, when I come to the throne of God, we've escaped the storm. We're out of the storm, away from it. Then it may be that it symbolizes mercy. That mercy surrounds the throne, and all that God does, both his righteousness and his justice and judgment to go out of that righteousness, are tempered by his mercy. Because he always is manifested as a merciful God, showing mercy unto thousands, as we read this morning in our Bible study of the name of Jehovah there. Showing this unto thousands. So I think it symbolizes mercy. So here is a throne with a flashing diamond, a flashing red coming forth. Round about it is an emerald. The rainbow like unto an emerald in that. Well, that gives a little more of the picture there. Now notice further, when John said, I was in the Spirit, he said that also back in the first chapter in verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. Right? Now, I don't think that he was ever out of the Spirit, but this to emphasize again that being in the Spirit is he is subject to the Spirit, controlled by the Spirit, and the Spirit is revealing these things unto him. No, not a stronger force of it, but the same thing I think you had there. Right now, here was the one that sits upon the throne, and what he was like in the rainbow, like an emerald round about. Now you have several expressions here that I want to note concerning this throne, and try to keep them before that here. So first of all, round about the throne. Now this expression here, round about. Right? Then we have out of the throne. Then we have such expression as that. Now notice round about the throne, you had this this rainbow, and round about the throne were 24 thrones, and upon the thrones I saw 24 elders sitting, arrayed in white garments, and on their heads crowns of gold. Right? Now also round about the throne here, first of all, was this rainbow. This rainbow like unto an emerald, which I think suggests mercy. It may suggest something else, but that seems to be it. And here you have 24 thrones here, and elders upon these thrones here. Well, now these are round about. I don't know what kind of a picture you would draw of this. One man in one book that I have, he has a semicircular throne here, back against the wall, now the wall of the judgment hall. And then here are steps coming up, and here's the throne in the center. Now around about here, these 24. Another individual who sought to try to describe it, he raised something like this. Here you go to a square here, the steps coming up here. So here is a row of steps here, and comes up here.
And then my mother allowed him that kind of way to get around here.
Yes, I get my dad.
And then you have another bit of contract. And so here is the one on the throne here, right under a jasper. I'm sorry, Father, the jasper stone. That's all we know about it here. Right, now these are steps. And these steps here come up. Why, you pass up to that. I have round about the throne here, the 24 are elders. I don't know how they would look there, but something like this. Get around. These are 24 elders right in front of them.
All right, now let's notice them for a moment. Now, know they too are on thrones. Now, the throne is a symbol of divine rule, divine power. So they somehow rule. Right? As we look at these 24 elders, they too are sitting upon thrones there. Now, know they're arrayed in white garments. First, the number 24. Well, that immediately brings to mind the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 apostles. And so it seems that these symbolize the redeemed of the Old and the New Covenants that were redeemed through in the Old Covenant there, in the 12 tribes, from the 12 tribes, and the New Testament, those that were redeemed by the preaching of the apostles. I think they symbolize the redeemed of both Old and New Testament, who now that have been redeemed around about in this picture now, in this vision that he has. Now, notice they are arrayed in white garments. White is a color of holiness in the Bible. Also, you have in Psalm 110, verses 1 to 3, Jehovah said unto my Lord, sit thou on the right hand, the light thine enemies, the footstool of thy feet, out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word from Jerusalem there, and thy people offer themselves willingly in the day of thy power in holy array. The old version, in the array of holiness there. Well, that suggests white, doesn't it? And so I think that's the idea here, that the redeemed, those that have offered themselves unto Jehovah willingly, they are arrayed in these white garments. They are arrayed in robes of holiness, or the array of holiness. And so that suggests the holiness of them, and the crown on their head is a victory crown. That's the stephanos, or the victory crown. And so here they are victorious, and being upon thrones, they reign with Christ. You have that in the New Testament a number of times. Ephesians, the second chapter, in verse 6, and he raised them up and made us to sit with him in heavenly places. Then in Romans 5, in verse 17, they that have received the abundance of grace and the gift of righteousness reign in life through the one, even Jesus. Revelation 5 and 10 that we'll read in next Sunday night. Why, here these men to be redeemed by blood, and God made them to be a kingdom and priests, and they reign upon the earth. So here you have saints reigning with Christ, reigning through Christ, that victory is through him. So I think that the elders symbolize the redeemed of Old and New Covenants, as they are pictured here in a symbolic picture. Not a literal thing, but a symbolic picture of 24 elders sitting upon 24 thrones round about the throne. And the throne indicates their reign together with them. All right, and white garment, purity. Now then, out of the throne. Now you have another thought. Here then is about the throne. Now then you have out of the throne. All right, so there suddenly comes out of. Here's the throne, these others around about. Now here's something proceeds out of the throne. Now, and out of the throne proceed lightnings and voices and thunders. And there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne. Now, we're back to before it now, which are the seven spirits of God. And before the throne, as it were, a sea of glass. These are all before. Now, let's go back to this thought here. Out of the throne proceed lightnings and voices and thunder. These are symbols of activity. But activity proceeds from the throne. They also impress the majesty of God, the power of God. God's operating here, are lightnings and voices and thunders here. that proceeded there. Action there. Activity proceeding out of the throne. So as you enter into this period of persecution, of tribulation, remember that out of the throne proceeds the judgment of God. It proceeds from Him. God is concerned there, and you have that. Now next you have, there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne. Well, there were seven lamps then. Here you have these around the about. Now here are the four, we have seven lamps here. And a better word for lamp is torch. They were torches. It's the same word that was used in John, the 18th or 19th chapter, where the mob came out, the rabble came out after them bearing torches. When we think of a lamp or a light, we think of something soft. It glows softly. When you think of a torch, you think of something more fierce. It expresses a more fierce concept of distributing light. But at any rate, these seven torches or lamps here, which are really torches, are burning before the throne there. Now they are back before the throne. So here you have now about before the throne, here you have the four, and out of this thunder and lightning and torches and thunder proceeding out of the throne, now here you have the torches, and there's seven of them, exuding a light, but it's a more of a fierce light. But it's a light that illuminates, instructs, now notice next what he says these are. And these which are the seven spirits of God. Right? And so here you have the seven spirits of God. Now, we had those introduced back in chapter 1. Now, what then are the seven spirits? Seven, the perfect number. Here's the perfect or complete full work of the Spirit. The Spirit of God. In one Spirit. Paul said one Spirit. The seven being a word denoting perfection or completeness here. Now here's a perfect or complete work or ministry or service of the Spirit, symbolized the seven here. Right? Now these are before the throne there. And now further, and before the throne, as it were, a sea of glass. Right? So we have before the throne these torches, which are the Spirit of God. Then you also have before the throne here a glassy sea. After the word glassy there, glassy sea. Right? Now what does that signify? Now try to keep in mind our picture here. Here then is our throne seen here. Here the lamp flashes, a torch is burning, and here's the flashing light from the diamond and the ruby red there. And over here is a glassy sea. Right here, then, it's a glassy sea. I don't know whether it's making something to look like a sea or not. You can think of something like that. Either glassy, calm, placid as it were. Right. Now, what does this suggest to us? That's before the throne. Right. Now, here is the saint. I think you can think of two things, maybe two or three that might symbolize. Being a glassy sea, it might introduce the peacefulness of the individual before the throne, because it's a glassy sea, indicating, I think, a shimmering, not rolling, but it's just a shimmering there. And I thought about this when I was on the island of Patmos, looked out over the Mediterranean there, and it was a placid day that day, and it was toward the sun, there was that shimmering there. And the idea hit me that maybe that was the idea. Two things. One was that here was the placidness of the situation before the throne, just as you have the rainbow round about it. Now when you have a rainbow round about it, that indicates that out yonder is the storm. It may be a storm all around, but here, when I see the rainbow, the storm is over yonder somewhere. That's all, we all know that. Right? And another thing this suggests to me is this. That all, as you look out across the shimmering sea there and see the sun shimmering upon it, think of the distance between you and the sun. I think of that when it comes to Jehovah. I think this indicates here a distance between the creature and the Creator. We're drawn nigh unto God, that's true. We live in His presence. But there's always the distance between God and me, or me and God, of the creature and the Creator. That's why, as we pointed out concerning the name this morning, the sin of vainly using the name of Jehovah because of who and what He is. Now then, the same thing is true of getting palsy-wowsy with Him here as an individual, and He is Jehovah. I think there's a distance, though I draw nigh to God and you will draw nigh to me, James said. We know that. But yet, when you've done that, there's still the distance of the creature and the Creator. I can never be too palsy-wowsy, too intimate with God. I must always respect, though I draw nigh to Him, and we live in His presence. I must always realize that there is that distance of creature and Creator. And I think that then helps me to hold in reverence the name of God. Hold in reverence is Thy name. I hold it in reverence when I realize the greatness of God, and that I am a distant, I am a creature, and He's the Creator. I believe that's the thought, at least that is a good thought from it, if not the one that John had in mind. It at least has satisfied me the best that I can suggest unto you. All right? And so now then you have then, here and the seven lamps before the throne, and here the seven, and before the throne, as it were, a glassy seal, a sea of glass, like unto crystal. In the midst of the throne and round about the throne, four living creatures full of eyes. Now here then, we have in the midst of the throne, you have here four living creatures. And the three here, the four living creatures here. All right, now in the midst, now what does that suggest? That suggests that somewhere here, in a very near proximity to God, would be these four living creatures. But they are in the midst of the throne, and yet they're round about. So if I put them on the throne here, on the steps of the throne, I'll just, or you could put them here if you wanted to, you could put them up here, in places like this, the nearest unto God here, of those creatures round about that. Now who are these four living creatures? Now let's look at them for just a moment and see if we can find something to help us. The four living creatures full of eyes before and behind. That suggests unto me at least that they're seeing into the future, but they also see into the past. They have served God in the past, they serve Him in the future, they see what's going on in the past, they see what is going to be and will go on in the future. At least they will have eyes to see into that as it comes to pass. So the eyes behind and for a little in the next statement concerning, the eyes are without and within. So they see within themselves also. So here then, in the midst of the throne and round about the throne, four living creatures full of eyes before and behind. Now he described these, the first creature, and the King James is a very unfortunate translation of beast. There were four beasts. There's an entirely different word for beast. The word for beast is theron, and it's used later on of the beast over there that came up out of the sea, a wild beast, the beast that came up out of the earth. The word here is zoe, which is life. And so here is living creature. So they should have never been translated a beast, because they are not that at all. They are living creatures. They are creatures of life, and that's divine life, because they are here next to the throne of God and serving God. And so these individuals, living creature is a much better expression than the King James word there. It's not that. Now note the description of them here. And the first creature was like a lion, the second like a cat, the third creature had the face of a man, the fourth creature was like a flying eagle. Now before we look at that, let's look at the next. The four living creatures, having each one of them six wings, are full of eyes round about and within. Now notice they're not only without and within. Now the other expression, before and behind, looking into the future and into the past. Now then here this one says that they had these eyes within and without. They see and know what's going on without. They also know and look within themselves, and they see within themselves who they are and what they are. They have that insight there. Now what they do is keep vigilant over the creation of God, the things of God. I want to notice two or three things about them. First of all, the four faces. One was like a lion. The next one there was like a calf, and the like a face of a man, and one like a flying eagle. Well, I think those express the idea of strength and majesty, such as the lion. Here is the calf, the servant. Service indicates service there. And like unto a man, intelligence. And like unto a flying eagle, swiftness. Swiftness in carrying out whatever the will of God is. Now, something like that is the significance of it. Now, these are the same four faces that Ezekiel's cherubim had in the first chapter and in the tenth chapter of the book of Ezekiel. The difference is this. These have one face each. Ezekiel's cherubim have all four faces. Each one of them has the four faces. The face of a lion, the face of an ox there, or a calf, the face of a man, and the face of a flying eagle. But this one has only one. Now, another thing, in Ezekiel's description back there of these cherubim, they had four wings. But now know that these have six wings. Well, now that relates them unto Isaiah's seraphim. In Isaiah the 6th chapter, in verses 1 to 5, Isaiah said, "In the day that Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And above him were the seraphim. Each one had," don't know how many, he doesn't number them. "Each one had six wings. With two he did cover his feet, with two he covered his face, and with two he did fly. And they spake one to another, saying, Holy, holy, holy is Jehovah of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory. Then Isaiah said, I cried out of a man of unclean lips, for I have seen the glory of Jehovah." And so, now these have six wings. So, you have a combination here. John, in his description here, his use, he draws from all sources that will present what he has to say, what he's trying to teach. So here you have a combination in this of Ezekiel's cherubim and of Isaiah's seraphim. They have both in this. Well, all right, now notice their eyes. They have six wings full of eyes round about and within. And they have no rest day and night, save. Now, they're keeping constant vigilance over the divine creation, over the divine purpose. They are, if you were to ask me, one man thinks that they are symbols of creation, of the created universe. I don't. I think they are the highest order of divine, of beings round about the throne. I don't know, the word archangel is always in the singular. And so, whether they're more than one archangel, I don't know. But I think these four living creatures symbolize the highest order of angelic beings or creatures around the throne of God that render him service and carry out his mission and will. And when we think of it like that, why, that I think fits in. But notice where they are. They're closer here to the occupant of the throne there. They're around they're in the midst of the throne and around about the throne, above. Now notice their song. And these four living creatures, and now they have no rest day and night, saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God the Almighty, who is and who was and who is to come." Right? Now, notice that differs from the seraphim of Isaiah. "Holy, holy, holy is Jehovah of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." But now these say, "Holy, holy, holy, the Lord God the Almighty, who was and who is and who is to come." Now what does that song suggest? The song of the 24 here, the other 24 living creatures round about. Now they sang this song, that suggests three things. The tri-holy there, same as you have back in Isaiah. But that indicates the absolute divine holiness of God. I don't think it refers to the Trinity, the three persons. I think it symbolizes the fullness, the completeness, the perfection of God's absolute holiness, the tri-holiness. In Lord God the Almighty. Now that indicates His absolute power, His divine and absolute power in all realms. Now, I remember preaching on that one time here, but I think I'm going to go back and redo that and try it again sometime, how the word is used back there of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, how that is also used by Job in the book of Job, and how it's used here in Revelation. And I think in Genesis and Revelation, it always refers to that absolute power of God to carry out His purpose, to accomplish His will. So that was the divine purpose of God, the plan of salvation. We'll talk about next time. Let me hasten along now. And then who is to come, was, is to come, His eternity. So here is His absolute holiness, His absolute power, and His eternal being are summed up in that wonderful song of the four living creatures. Now note, when the living creatures shall give glory and honor and thanks to Him that sitteth on the throne, to Him that liveth forever and ever. Now note that liveth forever and ever indicates what I've said about who was and is to come. He's the one that lives forever. And so I think my interpretation of that is correct based on that ninth verse. The 24 elders now shall fall down before Him that sitteth on the throne, and shall worship Him that liveth forever and ever, and shall cast their crowns before the throne, saying. Now notice what they do. They sitteth on the throne, those that fall down before the throne. Right now these 24 here, now I'll come back to them now, who we have up here. Now that they fall down before Him, and they worship Him, and then they cast their crowns before Him. Now, what does that casting of the crown symbolize? Since the crown is a victory crown, the wearing of these crowns indicate their victory and reign with Christ. Now, to cast those crowns before the throne occupant here, thus acknowledging their salvation and their victory as coming from the throne. So, it's from the throne of God what God is willed and what God has done from His throne as the throne occupant of the universe is what He has done there that has given us our redemption, has enabled us to wear the white robes of righteousness and of truth, and wear the crown of victory, and the casting of the crown before the throne to me symbolizes that worship and acknowledgement that their victory and their redemption is from God. God is the source of all of that. Now, one last thought. Now comes their song. Now, their song is the song of creation. Worthy art thou, our Lord and our God, to receive the glory and the honor and the power. Now, notice there's a threefold praise there that they offer unto Him, worship unto Him, glory, honor, and power. For thou didst create all things, and because of thy will, they were and were created. Now, I know I've quoted that passage many times because it has so many applications in to me in preaching. That is here now, that because of thy will, they were. Here's the will of God. Now, they were and were created. So now, what does that mean? That here, before the creation, in the will of God, creation already was. Nothing is an afterthought. In his will, here's what he's going to do. Now then, because of our will, they were and were created. So the whole created universe is an expression of the divine will of God. It was first in his mind. There was no idea there of evolution or all of that. Here's the idea of the creature and the creation rather than the creature. And because of our will, they were and were created. And so this is their song then. So these sing, the four living creatures sing the song of Jehovah's holiness, His power, His eternity. Now these 24 elders, these that have been redeemed, now they sing the song of His the power expressed in the creation. All of the power of God's will was expressed in the creation back there, and because of thy will they were and were created. And so now with this before the saints, as we sit out here in the auditorium, or sit here in the arena, around the thing here, over here at the stage, and we watch this. We see the throne, we see the throne occupant. Now then we see also here four living creatures about the throne. Round about the throne we also see 24 thrones and elders upon them. We see coming out from the throne here the thunders and lightnings and all of that. So we see, and in the midst of the throne and round about it, we see the four living creatures and what they are doing. And so in all of this, we're simply given a picture of the grandeur and the glory of the throne of the universe. And since the throne rules and controls and the power rests there, then let the storm burst. Let the Romans do all they can to destroy the church of God or any other force. As long as you hold on to God, the victory is guaranteed. Because the power is there. It emanates from Him, all power does. Well, we'll stop there. Next Sunday night, I want to talk about the Lamb and the book in the fifth chapter. They occupy the central point in that particular chapter. So we'll leave the lesson there, and we'll stand together now and sing the song of conclusion to our study for tonight, and take it up there next time.